I got it.
All right, now we're going to move on to our last session, common exam findings and how to prepare for an NFA exam, which a lot of our members find very helpful, especially if you're going to have an exam soon. So with us for this last session, we have Brad Jaeger and Angela Muzai from our OTC derivatives department.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate your time, and bear with us for about 30 more minutes as we wrap this up. So I did hear that our exams are valuable, not at all time-consuming, and a very nice experience. So with that, I think we can wrap it up. We'll definitely leave some time for questions. Don't ask me when your next exam is. If I knew, I wasn't allowed to tell you anyway. So don't ask me outside either. I can't tell you. Just to get into a little bit about our exams, I know a lot of you in this room have gone through multiple exams. A lot of you, my former colleagues, have led a lot of NFA exams, so you're very familiar with the process. So I do just want to go through a couple high-level things. The scope of our exams are determined by the specific characteristics of each swap dealer. First and foremost, are you a non-U.S. entity or a U.S. entity? That drives a lot of what rules apply. Also, if you're prudentially regulated or not. So that's really a starting point, is really a firm profile, dealer by dealer, to determine kind of big picture what's in play for us from an exam perspective. The second thing we really look at are the potential risks. You know, we look at each swap dealer on an ongoing basis through annual filings, CCO filings, our quarterly risk exposure reports, risk data filings, and other things. We also have dedicated exam managers for each swap dealer. If you don't know who your dedicated exam manager is, don't hesitate to reach out to anyone at NFA that you do know with any questions or concerns that you have, outside of an exam cycle. Like we're always open to, to self-reporting issues or troubleshooting remediation, on an ongoing basis. So anything you need, make sure you reach out to those people, and we'll take the time to help. In the course of an exam, our exams may not look and feel the same, even for a specific swap dealer from one exam to the next. We may do different types of testing. In the past, when the exam program first started, we looked at, from a horizontal perspective across all swap dealers, what's the CCO function like? In the big picture, what does the risk management program look like? And we did horizontal reviews. Exams may feel a lot more vertical. We may look specifically at, a small subset of trading activity within a particular asset class and really do a deep dive into that trading activity. We may look at the pre-trade records, the negotiations that leading up to execution, the disclosure of pre-trade marks, the confirmation, and then communications on a post-trade basis and daily mark disclosures. How are the swaps being valued day-to-day? How does that flow into variation margin and those requirements? So the exam may feel a bit more vertical and a bit targeted. That's by design. We want to keep the program flexible so that we have the ability to look at areas that are of concern to us, where there may be potential risks, and we can design our testing, appropriately based on those risks. On-site fieldwork, we are several years post-COVID now, thankfully. Hopefully, we do continue to kind of expand our on-site exam work. And while we're there, we want to make the best use of that time for us and for you. We want to make sure that, we have the ability to meet with specific employees and specific stakeholders that actually carry out the functions that we're examining. We don't want to just hear from regulatory relations people, as great as they are, but we do need to hear directly from the stakeholders that actually carry out the tasks. And we want to make, our on-site time as effective and efficient as possible. To wrap up, again, I know the last panel talked about it, that transparency. If you have questions about a request, you have questions about a meeting topic or an agenda that we want to talk through, have those conversations with the exam team, with the managers, the supervisors that are on the exam, and have those conversations in advance of responding to a request. It really does go a long way to avoid those pain points of kind of having a back and forth where we're talking past each other. It's definitely not by design. We don't enjoy writing multiple requests either for the same topic, so those conversations definitely go a long way. And we'd encourage everyone to kind of take that approach. And we do realize there is a large volume of requests for these exams. You know, even if we're only looking at a specific set of trades, there's a lot that goes into a single OTC trade. And if there's a way for you to respond using RFS that's more efficient, we're open to those ideas. Typically, you know, we list those requests out one by one. It helps us keep track. We've heard feedback from some swap dealers that it helps them keep track, helps you keep track. But if there's a better way to respond, you know, let us know and have those conversations as well, not just about the substance of a request, but logistics. Like, we want to make it as efficient as we can. You know, obviously, there's a lot of requests. That's probably not going to change, but we do want to make it as efficient as we can. So definitely have those conversations with us as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to Angela for a bit.
Thank you, Brad. And with that, I'll first kick off with the Internal Control Questionnaire, or the ICQ, which is serving as our first layer in gaining a deeper understanding of your firm's unique control environment. And as we find ourselves at the stage where many of our member firms have undergone at least two rounds of capital examinations, you will find that we are treating the ICQ as a living, breathing document. And to further define what I mean by a living or live document, you can first expect that the ICQ template given to you at the start of the examination will be pre-populated with responses that we received from the prior year. While we understand that your controls might not change significantly from year to year, we do expect that the ICQ is a document that you are continuously updating to reflect any changes to your control activities. This may include, but is not limited to, changes in the control process itself, the systems that you're using, or even the groups who are responsible for overseeing or executing that control. This is all part of an effort to make the ICQ more of a lift and shift exercise rather than something that requires wholesale edits from you. And as a result of this streamlining effort, we are also expecting a quick turnaround when supplying the ICQ at the start of an examination. Further, as part of that live nature of the ICQ, you may find our exam teams coming back to you with suggested changes or requests for additional information throughout the course of the examination. For example, we expect that the information you provide within your ICQ very closely aligns with the internal control walkthroughs that we conduct while we're on site. If we're noticing discrepancies or gaps between ICQ and your internal control walkthroughs, that will prompt us following up with you, asking questions, and then potentially proposing amendments to your ICQ before we finalize that document for your firm and carry those responses forward into the next year. Now, as far as the actual ICQ responses themselves, aim for as much detail as possible. Our goal is to gain a fulsome understanding of your firm's control activities, and we're expecting to see key information such as the stakeholders who are performing the control, the frequency of the control, the systems that you're using, what are the specific steps to execute this activity, and lastly, any escalation procedures if applicable to that control. If the ICQ responses are a bit higher level or we have some clarifying questions, that is once again a moment where you can expect us to follow up and, where necessary, provide suggested revisions. As part of your responses to the ICQ, you may include supporting documents or exhibits. You can choose how you want to present this. I've seen some firms directly embed the document within the ICQ response. Others choose to go for separate submissions through RFS. We are comfortable with whichever approach, but the note that I do want to make is that although policies and procedures are supporting documents, those alone will not fully satisfy the questions within the ICQ. We do require a written representation for each question or section within that document. That being said, similar to Brad's previous point on the preliminary questionnaire, we do not expect you to upload a separate RFS submission for each question or section. You can choose to upload it as a single centralized document. Once again, we're going for a process that is streamlined and the least burdensome to both you and us. But to step away from the ICQ for a moment, I do also want to highlight that this concept of a live document will come back to haunt you in the future at some point. We are, as part of our ongoing information gathering efforts, we are also working on modifying our questionnaires and developing new ones. And part of that streamlining process is, once again, as we're maturing a bit more, we're going to take your responses from the prior years and roll them forward, where you're only going to require changes in those questionnaires if the actual process or answer has changed, if we have clarifying questions, or if we added a new question to that questionnaire. This is all playing a role in us developing a deeper understanding of your firm before we hit the ground running with your examination, while still trying to make that effort streamlined. But now to bring us back into the internal control environment, there's one more section of this. So if the ICQ is serving as our first layer in gaining an understanding, then you can view the internal control walkthroughs as the second layer in now seeing that control environment in action. During those walkthroughs, we are expecting to speak to the stakeholders who are actually executing the control. It is okay for managers or supervisors who oversee them to be present within the call, but we are interested in speaking directly to the individuals who are pressing the buttons on their keyboard. We also want to then see those stakeholders provide a live demonstration of the activities that they are executing, and we want to see that demonstration for a current date rather than an audit date. So to provide a more concrete example, let's take the review and approval of the capital computation. In this case, we first would speak to the individuals who are responsible for reviewing and approving that computation. And as part of our conversations, we want to understand, what are you looking at? What are you analyzing to get comfortable with your capital computation? Then we'll want to gain some insight into how are you documenting this process. And lastly, we want to see it in action. So one example could look like meeting with the stakeholder and then logging into the platform that generates that daily net capital computation. Then we'll watch them review the document, analyze it for any unusual variances or balances, and then lastly, watch them sign off in that platform evidencing their approval of the capital computation. Some of our member firms do like to prepare presentation decks, and some of these decks are immaculate. I can tell that there is a lot of detail that goes into it. But unfortunately, what you will see from us recurrently is that we'll oftentimes go, wow, wonderful presentation. I still need to see that live demonstration, so you're not free for me quite yet. Until we see that demonstration, we do not consider our walkthroughs fully satisfied. This oftentimes looks like sharing your screen or us even sitting next to the person who is executing the control throughout the day. And although I've kept this slide largely focused on capital and the internal control environment, I'm sure you're noticing some common themes. And a lot of the core tenets that I've addressed here overlap in all of our walkthroughs. Regardless of the area that we're touching on, we want to speak to your stakeholders and we want to see this in action. So to give you an example that's not capital related, let's take a hot topic, trade surveillance. Oftentimes, there's always a meeting deck that comes with your trade surveillance walkthroughs. We sit down, we talk through it, but at some point, we would want to speak to the individuals who are reviewing your trade surveillance alerts. We want to get a sense of what are they looking at, again, what buttons are they clicking, and what considerations are they making as they complete their daily process. And then to tie out that trade surveillance walkthrough, we would want a demonstration of your surveillance platform, and we want to see the alerts that were generated for that day. Perhaps we'll click into a few. But then, at that point, I would consider our trade surveillance walkthrough satisfied. As a final note on walkthroughs, if you contact your examination team, you do have flexibility to customize your meeting schedule. So I know, especially in that first day letter, we tend to give you a preset template. Depending on your stakeholders and their availabilities, you can take our meeting requests and either break them into smaller pieces in multiple meetings, or you can consolidate them into a larger session. But once again, communication with your team is paramount here, and we are more than happy to accommodate your needs wherever possible. Now, on to the next slide. I will be touching on fieldwork requests in a bit more detail, first beginning with the general ledger, as this is an item that we tend to get questions on. All capital examinations will require a download of your firm's general ledger as of the audit date. And this output is separate from the trial balance request that you'll normally see us send through in the beginning of your exam. The general ledger output should come from the source of truth. And this should be the system that is supplying your month-end financial filings and feeding the numbers that are going into that. Although there is considerable variability amongst our members' general ledger outputs and how it presents, We do not need this data to look pretty. We don't need it in a specific format, and oftentimes your GL output does look like a data dump. But the kind of bare minimum that we're looking for is we want to see the ending balances for all accounts and subaccounts as of your audit date. Now, depending on the size of your firm, you may be a smaller shop that has a smaller ledger and a lower volume of activity. In that case, you can also expect us to ask for journal entry activity that has been happening for that month of your audit date. So if your audit date is January 31st and you're a smaller shop with minimal activity, we will ask for the entire month of January's journal entry activity so we can get a greater view into how you're moving day to day and that overall profile of your firm. For some of our larger firms, that is not practical, unfortunately. So there you will see us picking a sample of accounts and subaccounts and grabbing that journal entry activity. Now, if you have any concerns on whether the data that you're supplying us is fitting the bill, or if you have concerns about the volume, the best way to handle this is to reach out to your exam team. Oftentimes, it is a phone call, sharing screen, and we find a middle ground that works best for both of us. But now turning to fieldwork requests as a whole, you will typically see our requests hit the ground with a 3-day turnaround. However, not all requests are built equally, and they can require differing degrees of effort to source. So for any items where you have clarifying questions or may require an extension, we do ask that you engage the exam team as soon as possible and refrain from contacting us with extension requests the day that a request is due. This helps us ensure that the examination is moving in a timely manner and helps us reduce any unnecessary delays. If you are requesting an extension, please include an estimated submission timeline and some additional context for the delay. Sometimes we may be looking at a situation where a stakeholder is out on PTO. Other times we may be dealing with something a bit more complex that requires teamwork between us and the swap dealer to navigate. But regardless of where you're falling on this spectrum, the best path forward is timely and clear communication with your exam team. And you've heard this multiple times throughout, especially with our last panel. It's very easy to get caught in the rabbit hole with us. Sometimes our requests are nuanced. Sometimes you may receive a request from NFA and go, wow, what do you actually want from me? And if you're sitting there thinking that, I promise we have a testing objective in mind. And if it's not clear, the easiest path forward is get on a call with us. Sometimes we need to speak with the regulatory coordinator. Other times it's speaking with the stakeholders themselves who are providing the requests. You know your processes very well, and sometimes our requests have some practical limitations. So this is all in the spirit of working together rather than getting caught up in 3 rounds of back and forth requests and still not quite answering what we're looking for. On a final note, on the opposite side of that spectrum, you can also expect a shorter turnaround for any off-the-shelf requests that should be readily available, such as a 1-day turnaround for a policy and procedure. And if you are able to upload a request ahead of our deadline, we encourage you to do so. It gives us more time to look at your request and get back to you if there is something that we think is missing. And with that, I will turn it back over to Brad to get into trade data submissions.
I was going to say, we'll finish with the exciting stuff about rule violations and remediation. You know, for us, that's exciting anyway. But first, trade data. We've requested trade data from our swap dealers for several years now. You've all seen the template, I'm sure. And at first, it was definitely a challenge to get that trade data, get it accurate, get it comprehensive, and get it back to us quickly. The trade data requests are not going to go away. So we encourage all of our swap dealers to take the time to try to systematically connect these different points of data. A good chunk of the data is the SDR data. It is enhanced by several kind of key fields, which are, you know, proven problematic to kind of pull in. Some firms have done it on a manual basis and had to do very comprehensive reviews of that trade data. We want to try to get away from that as much as we can, so we'll definitely deliver the message. You know, we're going to keep asking for trade data, so do your best to prepare for it. That being said, we'll talk a little bit about a couple of those kind of odd fields, just kind of one by one, just to give a little bit guidance in terms of like what we're generally looking for. And I'm sure you've had these conversations, you know, with your exam teams, and I've had them with several of you in the room before. The first set of data relates to the personnel. So who's the marketer, who's the salesperson, and who's the trader? You know, we want to get human names attached to specific trades. You know, it gives us an idea of who's actually soliciting and accepting swaps. You know, obviously, from a swaps proficiency AP perspective, you know, are these people properly identified as APs? Are you recording their phone calls and so on? So that's the first thing that usually requires a bit of manual input. The second two fields relate to markups. You know, we have a field for a salesperson markup and a separate field for a trader markup. Again, not every swap dealer records this type of information in the same way. We realize that. So the first thing that we do is to have conversations. How does your firm record this type of information? Again, our goal is to figure out how is each swap priced and what are the additions, what are the add-ons, what is the markup to make that trade profitable for the swap dealer. We realize some trades may not have a markup for some reason based on the product, how it's executed, or who the counterparty is. We need to have those conversations with you as well. So if you're providing, you know, a trader markup and it only looks like it's entered for half the trades, we want to know why it's not entered for this subset of trades. And there may be a very good reason. We've had good reasons presented to us in the past, but we do need to have those conversations, you know, with you guys to make sure that, you know, what we're seeing in the trade data makes sense from a big picture. And then also, I mentioned, you know, vertical reviews of specific trading activity. The markup could also be part of that, of those conversations related to specific trades or trading activity. And then we would expect the responses to be a bit more specific, you know, in nature to a specific trade. Okay, this markup was this for this reason. This is how it was priced. This is how the markup was determined. That's kind of once we do look at a sample of trades or specific trades. But again, the goal is to figure out how the swap dealer is making money on a trade-by-trade basis or a group of trades. And again, there may be good reasons why data is not available or it's presented in a way that's different from dealer to dealer. That's perfectly fine, but we do need to kind of assess those differences and those nuances. So bring those to our attention, you know, throughout the exam process. The last point, just on timing. Obviously, trade data is a bit more nuanced than pulling a policy and procedure off the shelf, so we wouldn't expect a one-day turnaround. That being said, we do want to be a bit more concerned about the timeliness of these requests, you know, as we go forward and we request the same data exam after exam. The first time we requested it, I think we were very patient with the turnaround time. But as we ask for it again and again, you know, we do expect dealers to kind of have this data more readily available and able to pull it together a little quicker and probably without so much manual intervention. So that's just a note on the timing. But again, have those conversations with the exam team. And if there's differences between asset classes, counterparties, how products are executed, if they're cleared or not, you know, how that all plays into the data and how these kind of key fields fit within that framework. One other field I just want to mention briefly is the day one P&L. Basically, what we want to get a sense of, was this trade profitable on day one? So we want the end of day valuation on the trade day. Some may have a very minor P&L, either positive or negative. Others may have what appears to be a very high P&L, either positive or negative, and there may be a reason for that. You know, it could be, you know, a reset event or something that's booked as a new trade that shows a large P&L. If we do see things that look abnormal, we may ask about them, and there could be reasons for a large P&L or a large negative P&L. But those are conversations that you could expect to have as well. And there are probably good reasons for it, but those are things that we'd be curious about when we do review the trade data. The last slide also contains the areas of concern. So as the exam moves forward, we want to bring things to your attention as soon as we identify them. The first things I would consider like an area of concern. We may have had a conversation or reviewed policies and procedures, and we may not understand what the firm's doing in specific areas. We may identify those as an area of concern. And again, the goal is to kind of start additional conversations, or maybe we would perform additional detail testing within those areas. We may not have a specific rule violation, but we may identify, you know, an area where internal controls are not best practices that we've seen elsewhere. So it may not be a rule violation, but it may be something we ask in additional questions about and have additional meetings about, again, or do additional detail testing. And we like to put those in writing. Everyone's probably seen our preliminary issue tracker. We like to identify the specific section of rules, regulations, what we're seeing, and then any commentary. And we like to do that in addition to verbal conversations as we identify areas of concern. And the goal is to make it a transparent process earlier in the exam and not the last minute before the report goes out. So that's the goal, and you know, we'll do our best to kind of stick to that. If there's something we do identify at the last stage of review, it will happen. We apologize for it. It's not something we enjoy doing, but if it's a rule violation that we see towards the end, you know, we have to pursue it that way. But again, the goal is, again, transparency throughout the process. The next type of thing I would call a preliminary issue, something that we would consider a rule violation based on currently available information. If there's something like that that's brought up and you have additional documentation, additional information about a specific rule violation, you know, we're definitely open to hearing those things. If you have a disagreement about how we're applying the rule, whether you know we're missing a nuance, whether you think a no action covers something, you know, bring those things to our attention right away as well. We're open to those things. And if there's additional documentation, bring those to us as well. We're more than happy to talk through our approach to interpreting the rules and the nuance of certain things. So bring those to our attention as well. Again, we call it a preliminary issue tracker because it's preliminary. We want to have those discussions and well in advance of a report going out. By the time you receive an exam report, we want everything to be agreed to, the fact pattern, how we're interpreting the rule, and how we apply the rule. So we want all those things hashed out well in advance at the end of the exam. And to do that, you know, bring those things to our attention, you know, throughout as we would like to do as well. Lastly, remediation. So we do bring things to your attention that we do consider a rule violation. You know, we go through the fact pattern, you agree. Then the next stage is, what do we do to fix it? That takes a lot of different shapes. If we're seeing a lack of a policy and procedure in a particular area, it could be as simple as updating the compliance manual, showing us the new version. Great, we're done. And correcting things that are low-hanging fruit, that are easy to correct during the course of the exam, could persuade us to leave those types of things off the examination report at the end. We bring it to your attention. You, in good faith, address it quickly. And if it's you know something that's not very material, I guess is the way to say it, we can consider leaving those things off the report. So we encourage remediation quickly and diligently throughout the exam, not just after you get the exam report. Other items that we bring up, they require working groups, they require research, they require looking at things on a global basis, not just how NFA interprets the rule. You have other regulators that you have to comply with as well around the globe. So it may not be as simple as to just snap your fingers and fix something that requires a lot more nuance. We're aware of that, and we will work with you on those types of things and show some patience on those as well. What we do expect is some type of short-term correction so that you're not in ongoing non-compliance. You don't want to be in a position where you know you're not in compliance, but we know we can't do anything about it for 6 months until we figure it out. Like, those situations we want to avoid, and we want to work with you as best we can to kind of help you avoid those as well. So if there is some type of short-term manual fix that may be resource-intensive, we would encourage you to kind of take those steps, again, to avoid those kind of ongoing non-compliance items. While in the background, you're working on that additional research and you're working on that more technological systematic solution. And again, any remediation plan, NFA is not going to come in and tell you this is the exact thing you need to do. We will have a dialogue with you. It's like, this is generally what we expect, but the finer points of the remediation plan are really up to each member. And then if you have questions about, okay, if we do X, Y, and Z, is this good enough? We can always have those conversations with you, but we don't generally dictate, okay, this is the exact thing you need to do to address an issue. But we do like to have those conversations, you know, as you consider the remediation plan, whether it's a short-term or kind of long-term solution. But again, I'll say it one last time, transparency and that dialogue back and forth really do go a long way, and we've heard it, I think, probably from every panel, so I won't say it again. But we do like to engage with our members, and we like to hear from you. As we learn from you, it helps the exam program get better and better. So with that, I'll stop and open it up to questions.
That was great. Thank you. Just a couple of questions on trade data or the blotter request. You mentioned day one P&L being end of day valuation. By that, do you mean mark to market?
Generally, yes. Most dealers respond with the end of day mark to market.
Okay, and just I guess what we would pull back there, considering you're looking for day one P&L markups, etc. Is the blotter restricted to new executions or all bilaterally agreed activity within the scope and period?
Our request is for new trade activity on a day-by-day basis. Obviously, as different events occur or a trade is renegotiated or reset, sometimes those come up as new trades in the trade data. We do understand that, and those things can get commingled and a little messy. The request is for new trades, but if there's something that's negotiated, an update to a trade, like we would expect to see those as new trades as well.
Okay, thank you.
Earlier, you talked about internal walkthroughs, control walkthroughs. When you have a regulatory function that's outsourced, is the NFA's expectation that we provide you with access to vendors or to key personnel who are performing outsourced but key regulatory functions?
I would say the best first step is to help us get an understanding of how you're using that third-party vendor and what exactly is the regulatory function that it's providing for you. And then from there, we would want to gain some comfort on how you are keeping your eyes on the vendor and what controls do you have on your side. We may ask for a demonstration of how you access the vendor. We may ask for insight on conversations that you have with the vendor, but I would say from that point on, it will be highly tailored to your unique firm.
A follow-up question. Mm-hmm. What if it's an affiliate?
If it's an affiliate, I would say the process is still quite similar. We still need to gain an understanding of what that control is and who the key players are. And once we get that baseline understanding from there, we'll be able to determine effectively how far do we go into this walkthrough. So I would say if at any point you don't know where to draw the line, calling the examination team and giving us that high-level overview will allow us to take that back internally and then get back to you on how far to go.
See, I cut off the questions. When is my next exam? There's no more. Sure. Dana, thanks everyone for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So once again, we would like to thank you for attending today's program. We hope that you will follow up with us with any further questions you have or issues. On our screen, you'll see the NFA Information Center email and also their number if you have any questions. And usually the Information Center does a great job at taking you to another individual that can help you. As always, NFA is committed to working with you towards compliance, so we appreciate your feedback, and we look forward to working again together. Thank you.